The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 148 for April 7th, 2008. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton. Of course, John Braun is here as well. Hi, John.
Hi.
How are you?
I've had such mechanical woes.
It's nice to be back in the digital realm, as it were.
Yes, it had to do with automobiles, but suffice to say, the problem is solved. Yes, the vehicle is 15 years old, but I think I will replace it, so...
You really do hold on to things for a long time. Cell phones, computers, vehicles. It's just in your nature, huh?
And to me, it's kind of a, I don't know, I'd say a geek thing or a hacker thing, but just, you know, I treat my machine well, it treats me well, and we have a relationship, and then it breaks down, and I have to find...
You have to shoot it.
And for the most part, Apple products make me so happy. And like my car, which is dying now, which is a Saturn 94 with 215,000 miles. Yes, it's dying too. So
that's a lot of miles, man.
Anyways, this weekend. Oh, gosh, I told you a bit about this and then we'll move on. But I test drove a Infiniti G35.
Nice.
The car is nuts.
Wow. That's a step up from your Saturn.
Careful. The problem is you're going probably above the posted speed limit and you don't know it. So anyways, moving on to things Mac instead of things fun car. But if you have comments on what you think I should get, please let me know. Because I'm having fun. I'm in the test drive stage, so it's a lot of fun.
That's the best part. Shopping for stuff like that is so much fun because you get to go and just drive all these cars or, you know, whatever it is, cars or computers or watches or whatever it is. Once you finally make your purchase, it's like, I'm done shopping. Now I just have it. You know, it's
but in this
all,
case,
almost
there's
like a letdown.
Competition. Hello,
of course.
Dealer X. I'm looking at dealer
right.
I and Z. And so that's the thing. There's a lot of competition and, you know, interest rates are probably as good as they're going to get.
Yeah. Yeah.
Moving on.
Cool.
So, but we have Mac people with Mac problems, and
we do. We have a lot of questions, and basically if there is such a thing, a normal show tonight. All sorts of stuff. Talking about networking, some different time capsule things and time machine things, because that's really a popular topic right now. I've got a little story that I'll share at the end about how I finagled some technology to work, and really, that's it. But the first thing we're going to talk about is RAM, and more specifically, well, you know what? We'll let Robert talk to us, and then we'll read Adam's question, and then we'll kind of roll it all into one answer together. I think. There we go.
Hello, this is Robert Hisrig, normally of New Jersey, but today I call you from the streets of Manhattan. I'm calling you because I have a problem with a G5 iBook. It has one 1.8 G5 processor, 2 gigs of RAM, it's running 10.4.11, and Creative Suite and Cork. It also is running Suitcases, the network version of Suitcases X1. And the issue that I have with it is it's notoriously slow. It's dog slow. I've worked on faster G3s. The system seems to start up okay. It doesn't matter what user I'm in, but eventually what happens is the system comes to a grinding halt as time goes by. For instance, when I was in the administrator user, I tried to copy a file or a group of files, 30 gigs of files, and it got to about the 9th gig or just under 9 gigs, and then it stalled. It stopped, and it took about 50 minutes to copy those 9 gigs, which is way too much. I found that tool on it, came up clean. I ran Disk Warrior on it, had a bad boot volume. Fixed that, but the problem persists.
Uh-oh. And his question starts to sputter out. You know, there's something wrong with FireWire on these Intel machines, FireWire audio on these Intel machines with I don't know, with 10.5, I think. Let's see if we can hear the end of his question.
I don't know if it's FedRAMP. I thought that tech tool would find that out for me. Don't know why it's running so slow, but would appreciate any insight you might have.
All right. And then Adam wrote, for the first time, I need to ask you guys a question. I've got a MacBook Pro 2.4 gigahertz with 2 gigs of RAM running a fully updated Leopard. I'm finding my machine slowing down a lot when I have a virtual machine open with VMware Fusion or just leaving this combination of apps open for a long period of time, iTunes, Firefox, and Mail. According to iStat menus, I'm paging out even though I always have at least 500 megs of RAM free. Any ideas? Then he goes on to share an Apple Store story that we'll read to you before we move on here. So in both of these cases, we've got users with apps open for long periods of time, some memory hog apps, right? CS, Adobe CS, Firefox, I know, kind of bloats up. iTunes can bloat up. Mail can bloat up. Certainly VMware Fusion can bloat up, John.
Safari.
So, well, Safari is the king of all bloatware, right? I think it's important to note what the free RAM means. The Mac OS X kind of lumps things into four categories, right? Active, wired, inactive, and free. Mm-hmm. Most of the menu utilities, like iStat menus or menu meters, add free and inactive together to find one number for free. And I think that's part of the problem here, because you can have inactive RAM and still things will page out. For me, I found that 2 gigs of RAM having a lot of apps open wasn't enough. I don't know what your thoughts are on what's going on here, John, but I think it's just neither one of these guys has enough RAM in their machine to do the things that they want to do without having to page.
Okay, I have thoughts. I'm going to share them with you.
We should first talk about paging real quick, right? That's when your system doesn't have enough RAM to hold, and this is a very watered down explanation, your system doesn't have enough RAM to hold everything that you need in RAM, and so it saves some stuff out to the hard drive to make more room in RAM. When it needs the stuff on the drive, it pulls it in. That process of saving it out is called paging out, and reading it back in is called paging in. So, and it's obviously slower to read and write from the hard drive than it is to just have the stuff in RAM. So, okay, go ahead, John.
All right. The one thing I have to say is if you are not running an application, it benefits you so much to quit it, because otherwise it's doing all sorts of things with the system. It may be well behaved, but still, if you're not using it, quit it.
I agree. I know other people disagree, but I've always maintained that no, Mac OS X, yeah, it's Unix. It's not built to, Unix isn't built to have multiple apps opening and closing all the time. It's built to have one app running and then that's it. So, it was built as a server OS. So, yeah, I agree with you. If you're not going to use something, quit it. Let the system have the RAM back. It will recycle it and use it eventually, but you've got to give it the resources to do that with.
Yeah. So that's my one big tip, and otherwise it kind of bothers me, because now that I have the nice MacBook Pro with right. 4 gigs of RAM, everything is wonderful. Everything is awesome. And I would say probably the same case to a lesser extent on, which is now my only Motorola machine. And I have on that, I think, 1.5 gigs. And every now and then it'll do the wacky paging right in, right out thing. And that's where one of the listeners, when he was saying, talking about the machine seeming to freeze, when I noticed this, his machine, I think it was a G4, although I think he said G5, whatever. But when you start getting to a point where you either get the spinning beach ball, or if you are using, and in this case I saw it, and that's why I just want to bring it up again, and punctuate this, is when you see the disk reading and writing, that's when VM is really, probably virtual memory is really in a bad state. And it's like, I don't know what to do. I'm going to read, I'm going to write. You know, it's probably clearing things out. It's trying to read. The bottom line is when the disk is involved in heavy activity, you can almost get nothing else done because it's one of the devices that, you know, rightfully or wrongfully so, has priority when it's asking the OS to do something. So,
yeah, that pretty much, I think that covers it. Yeah. So quit the apps. And if you can put more RAM in your machine, of course, that may or may not be an option depending on what machine it is. But yeah, to me, it sounds like both of these machines. And take a look.
Two is a borderline case, I think. But I think in both these cases, we were talking not 4 gigs, but even to me, 2 gigs, 1 gig, I would say, is probably not a good size for Mac OS X.
Just for example, oh, go ahead. Yeah. 2 gig. I would say 2 gigs is a minimum, but even still, like right now I've got Safari, Mail, Yojimbo, iTunes, Skype, Audio Hijack Pro open. That's it. And this machine was rebooted hours ago. This is the Intel iMac I have in the studio. It's got 4 gigs of RAM, but we've got just over 2 gigs free. So it's basically using 2 gigs of RAM right now. And yeah, that is a lot of apps open, but, it's not overloaded. It's all the things I need and nothing else. And maybe I don't need Mail running right now. In fact, it'd probably be good if I didn't have it running. But otherwise, that's the stuff I need to do the podcast. And there we are, right at 2 gigs. Now, it does say that there's, 150 megs inactive, but that's only inactive if the system can page it back in. It doesn't have it available at a moment's notice. So take a look at it, and you can see this in Activity Monitor too. When your machine seems slow, look for that free number because that's truly the number. Don't believe, like menu meters, if you put it in the menu, it'll say it'll have one used and one free, but that free is a combination of inactive and free. And if you're free, even if you're inactive, is it a gig and a half? If free is down at, 20 megs, the system's going to be swapping in and out, guaranteed. All right. Adam shared a quick little story and then we'll play Chadwick's question. Adam plugged his MacBook Pro into several outlets and realized the machine was not charging. It had four hours before, but just wasn't. He made an appointment at the Cambridge Side Galleria Apple Store, took the tea, didn't even have to wait. Genius was a very nice girl who was very knowledgeable and tested the power adapter, changed it out for one of the new smaller ones. And then he says, but this is where the awesomeness comes in. She noticed my battery was at a lower maximum capacity than it should be. After all, the machine plus battery was purchased in September when the Santa Rosas first came out, and my maximum capacity was around 95%. So she gave me a brand new battery for free. I do not have AppleCare, but because my machine and battery were still in their 1-year warranty, boom, new battery. Excellent. Yep. AppleCare, obviously he didn't need it at that point because he was still under the warranty period, but it pays for itself. I've always found that to be true. So,
well, it sounds to me also, this may be marriage material here. I mean, come on. Realizing that, I mean, that is going above and beyond the call of duty, I think.
Fair enough. All right. Let's see what, let's listen to this.
Hey, John and Dave, this is Chadwick. I just left the Apple Store here in Columbus, Ohio, and was just had an appointment with the Genius Bar, and unfortunately they weren't able to help him with any of my issues. But the most important one that I wanted to ask you about was USB power. I just purchased a portable hard drive that if I plug into my right USB port, powers up fine, runs fine, everything's dandy. If I plug it into my left USB port, as I'm looking at the machine, it won't power up. The OS comes up and tells me there's not enough power to run this device. The device doesn't work. It doesn't mount, all that stuff. And I asked a genius at the Genius Bar, and they said, yes, the USB ports on the MacBook Pro should be identical and should be pushing out the same amount of power. And then when I mentioned that, well, they're not, he was like, well, it's not exactly the same, and so this one might have it a little bit less, and then so now the onus is back on the third-party hardware vendor, and you know. Not-
I hate the FireWire audio on this machine. It's driving me crazy. Mm. We'll try this again. Here we go.
Back on the third party hardware vendor, and you know, not a very good answer in my opinion. If it works on the right side, it should work on the left if they're the same, and he wouldn't help me at all. The question I had was, is there some way to measure the power output on those USB ports? Is there a little tool that I can buy or some such thing that I can plug in there that would let me know exactly how much, you know, amperage or watts or whatever it's supposed to be is being shot out of those ports? Okay, well, thank you. And one other second quick question. I know you guys are big on AppleCare. I am too. They always do a good job. But what about ProCare? If you go to an Apple store, you can, for $99 a year, you can do ProCare, and they, like, help you do some different things. I know for a lot of us power users, it's probably not necessary. It's something that we would use. But maybe I thought it could be something you might chat about for some of the users that maybe don't know as much about their Mac. ProCare may be something that they might be interested in. Maybe worth their $99. Okay, have a great week. Talk to you later. Bye.
All right, John. USB power.
USB power, and what we're going to say about that is I would agree with the statement. Well, let's start at the beginning. Every USB source has and every USB source, you probably say, is a hub or a bus. And that's where you got to start when you think about how you think about power distributed among USB devices. Now, the statement that was made, I think, is more or less correct in that every USB port should have the same amount of power. But for example, in the case of at least the MacBook that I have, when you go into you know, Apple, about this Mac, more info, and then you get into the system profiler, one category, USB, will show you several USB buses. And the interesting thing here, which is why you may want to be careful about where you plug in your device, at least on this machine, one of the USB buses, which is one of the controllers on one side of the machine, because I verified this, I plugged in a device on the right and the left, and it was different. One bus has the EyeSight camera in the computer on that bus. So I believe it's on the right if you're looking at the screen. So in that case, the bus has more power on one side than the other if you are using the camera or the device. It, you know, that's where it gets kind of, and that's where I got kind of nervous about, is there a way for you to measure the current? Now, you got to remember the current is part of the equation that is used to compute power. Power is voltage times current. So you have the current limit, which is what USB devices report. And for the most part, that's a good metric. But at some point, I would say, even if you measured it physically, the thing is, what really drives the computer to provide or not provide power is what the devices say. So if the bus thinks it can provide amount of power and a peripheral thinks it needs something and it exceeds that according to what the device reports, then even if you measure it with a device like a, you know, multimeter, ammeter, I think you probably fiddle with one of those, Dave, like, yeah. I did back in our, you know, days of, you know, trying to understand and fix and hopefully, you know, repair electronics.
Right.
But anyways, I would say if the device says no, think of an option or get a powered hub. And I think that was part of where this question was going is, or if it's not, you know, power the hub and then you eliminate that restriction where the device has to be on the bus or powered by the bus.
Yeah, absolutely. It is strange that the keyboard would, I mean, I think it's just one hub, right, in the keyboard. So strange that one port would do it and another wouldn't. But like you said, it who knows how it's wired in there and why that is. I did find at a site called ultramobilegeek.com an article from last February or a year ago February where someone had actually built a box where you could hook up a little meter, a multimeter up to your USB port effectively and see what kind of power it could draw. Yeah, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. I, again, like John said, I don't think this is really valuable because it's not going to, it's not telling it that it needs to draw anything. So I don't know if it's going to get you what you want, but certainly fun for any of you geeks out there. Now, about Are we good with that, John? Can we move on to his ProCare question?
I think.
Okay.
Yes.
My feeling with ProCare is I know in some very busy cities, especially New York and San Francisco, the only way you're going to get an appointment at the Genius Bar is by having a ProCare card. You get advance access to those appointments and that sort of thing. And from what I understand, it's near impossible to get those appointments any other way. Now, the way I look at it is this. A Mac in New York, in New York City, costs the same as it does in, Kalamazoo, right, or anywhere else. And, you know, the cost of living in New York is higher, so add $100 onto it. That's the price of your computer. Now you can bring it to an Apple store, and you're good to go. That's kind of the way I look at it, and whether that's, you know, whether you like it or not, that I don't know. That's
I got to say, the only good news is I still believe Apple Fifth Avenue, the Cube, is the only 24/7 store. Is that correct? I think that's correct.
I believe that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Have you for now?
Have you been there at 3 a.m?
Not yet.
Okay.
Have you?
No, I've actually never been to that one. I was in New York last week for the first time since it opened. I hadn't been in Manhattan in quite a while. So,
and they have 3 now, I think, in New York City.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right. Our first sponsor for this show is Smile on My Mac with their product Text Expander. We've talked about Text Expander before. It is a product that I use constantly. In fact, while John was talking there, I was actually using Text Expander to build links into the show notes. The device that USB multimeter power draw measuring device, I wanted to put the link there. And with Text Expander, I was able to pull in their HTML library. And what Text Expander does is it lets you type a text shortcut for something that would be a much bigger piece of text. So, for example, I wanted to build an href link. So instead of typing open bracket A space href equals quotes and then putting the link in quote, closing quote, and then open bracket slash A close bracket, I just type comma A and bam, it populates the whole link. Puts my cursor right between the two quotes. I can paste in the URL, and I'm ready to go. It totally saves. And, of course, you can use the libraries that they provide, HTML. They've got some autocorrect libraries, kind of like the ones in your favorite word processors out there. But you can have them for email. You can have them for anything. You can also build your own. So if, for example, you have an email signature that you use a lot, you can do that. You can, of course, you can have it trigger an Apple script and do all sorts of different things. Really, really cool. And it's Text Expander. It's available for $29.95 from smileonmymac.com. And as long as you have Tiger or better, you're good to go. Of course, they have a free trial. So check it out, smileonmymac.com. All right, let's talk about networking, shall we, John? And let's hear what David has to say, because this is kind of weird, and I think we're gonna have some different ideas about why this is happening. It's just a hunch.
Hey, John and Dave, this is David calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Love your show. Keep up the good work. Got a quick question for you. I have shared computers showing up in my Finder. Obviously, neighbors' computers or something showing up. And I was wondering, how do you remove them? I don't see any way of removing them. They connect to your computer, and there's no way of forcing them to disconnect. I don't have any shared things turned on. So from a security standpoint, I think there just must be mooching off of my wireless connection since I don't have WEP or WPA turned on. I just hide my SSID and use MAC address filtering. However, they are showing up as shared computers on my network, so I was wondering how you get rid of them, if there's a way. And secondly, a simple question in mail. When I just go and copy-paste a hyperlink from Firefox real quick into an email I want to forward along, the link is not activated. I have to go up into the tools and, you know, highlight it and make hyperlink, and that's kind of a tedious process. So I was wondering if there's a shortcut that I'm not aware of just simply getting an active hyperlink in a mail, in an email. And so if you give me those two answers, would appreciate it. Keep up the great work. Look forward to listening to your future shows.
Thanks, David.
I got number one.
Okay, go.
Okay. So if you don't want to see the shared computers, then what you want to do is in Leopard, you go to Finder, Preferences, Sidebar, and then click on Bonjour Computers, and they will go away.
All right.
The only problem I have with the explanation is it solves the problem, but not, to me, the issue. Would you agree, Dave?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the question was, how can I not see these things? And that answer addresses the question. But I think it hints at a whole ugly underlying issue.
I wouldn't necessarily be happy with that as our standing answer and moving on. But you're right. Technically, it addresses it. The other way to do it, of course, would be to shut his computer off. He wouldn't see him then either. Right? I mean, you know, if you want to get technical.
I'm kind of at a loss, though, because from what I understand, this is Bonjour, which is one of those zero conf.
Right.
You know, kind of nice and easy ways to network on the same subnet so that if you see a machine nearby and you want to do things, the assumption, if they're on the same subnet, it's probably somebody I trust, and then you can do interesting things. But I'm at a loss, and I beg to our listeners, because you are so good to us, especially with iTunes comments and all that, but also with tips. But how do I did a quick search and I couldn't find a way, short of turning off networking, which I think you mentioned, Dave, but that's not very elegant.
No.
How do you hide the Bonjour or ZeroConf or whatever you want to call it, rendezvous? Sorry, that time has passed. But how do you shut that off? Because the thing is, I was just, and you were traveling recently. If you're in an airport, I was in an airport, and if I go to Bonjour or just, you know, networking on my brand new machine, but even not my brand new machine, my old machine, I would see so many machines connected, because the nature of the protocol is I'm going to say hi to everybody if I'm on a subnet that is, you know, close by.
yeah. Okay. But here's the thing. Let's take at face value what he said. He has his SSID hidden, which means that you would have to use something like, iStumbler to find the network. And then he's got MAC address filtering on. Now, the way I understood it, MAC address filtering doesn't let the computer even connect. So if you have MAC address filtering enabled and you have it properly enabled, the only computers that can even connect to your wireless network are those with your MAC address. Now, it's possible he's got a lot of really, really smart and you know, kind of sinister neighbors, and they've figured out what his MAC addresses are and spoofed them so that they can join the network. But that's a stretch, right? So either he doesn't have MAC address filtering turned on properly, or MAC address filtering doesn't work the way we think, but I'm pretty sure it does because I've used it, or the machines that he's seeing in his list there are shadows of machines that he has seen in the past, but aren't really there.
Good one.
So it's got to be one of those three. And I'm leaning toward the last one only because I'm just taking the rest of it at face value. Now, you can turn off. We did a little searching before the show started here, and we found a link somewhere here of how to disable Bonjour, and it's using launch D, and you go to the command line and launch control or launch CTL space unload, and then the path to the MDNS responder plist file, which MDNS responder is the system service that's responsible for Bonjour. So if you turn that off, it's possible those things would disappear, but I'm not even convinced that that would do it. I've seen this in hotels, and I've also seen it here. In fact, we've had a lot of people write in and say, yeah, you know, sometimes the computers and shared drives and all that on my network appear in that magic little list on the Finder, and sometimes they don't. You know, it's like the old Almond Joy commercial, but you don't know when. And but if you go to the Finder's Go menu and you go to Connect to Server and you choose Browse, that is an active browse of what's happening on your network at that point in time. So, as I'm talking this out here, the step that I would ask David to perform is do that. Go into the Finder, go to the Go menu, go to Connect to Server, and then click the Browse button. That and then wait about 30 seconds for, because that list may change. I've seen it repopulate itself a couple different ways. Wait until it stops. If you see things out there then they're actually on your network. If you don't, then the stuff in the sidebar is the shadows, and that even still I'm not sure how to get rid of, but at least we're honoring the troubleshooting process here, right?
Yeah, I think so. And in general, you want to go to, just to make sure you're not sharing anything you shouldn't.
Right.
Go to System Preferences, Sharing, and everything on the left, at least with Leopard, make sure it's not checked. And if it's checked, make sure you don't share it with more people than you really want.
Yeah. All right. The second part of his question was, when pasting a link into mail, it doesn't appear as a link. You've got to go and fight with it. My experience is, if you just want to send plain text email, go ahead and paste the link in. I often enclose it in brackets, the things above the period and the comma on a standard Mac keyboard, because that is per the RFC that says when you're sending plain text email and you have links in there, put the stuff in brackets and then you should be good to go. In theory, the receiving client will know not to break that up and it should work. If you send it out that way, the receiving client, even though you haven't gone and made it a link, the receiving client will see it as a link. I do it all the time and I don't have any problems with it. In fact, if I were to send an email to myself that way, and once I received it, I would see it as a link too. It just doesn't activate the link while you're typing. So I don't think you need to drive yourself crazy. Try it a couple of times, but I'm pretty sure you'll be all right with that. For those of you that want to call in, we should do this now, John, right before we get to the end and we've forgotten. If you want to send in a question, there's a lot of ways you can do it. You can email us, right? feedback@macgeekgab.com. You can Skype it to MacGeekGab. And somehow the Skype to our voicemail link has gotten a whole lot better in terms of audio quality. So I'm really happy about that. And then the last way, John, is they can call in. And the number is?
What is it? Oh, 206-666-GEEK, which is?
Yep. 4335. So 206-666-4335. And with that, we'll move on to James.
Hello, Dave and John. This is James Taylor calling. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I knew I loved your show when I first heard the band. By now, I know you guys are tired of repeating yourself about networking, but my problem is really simple, I hope. Tell me how to reset the network settings to start over with my connection with my two Macs. I have a Mac Mini and an iMac, both pre-Intel, both on a router. Sometimes I have connections, sometimes I don't. My Mac Mini sees the iMac, but my iMac don't see the Mac Mini. And how does Apple Talk fit into this equation? Thanks for your help, and most of all, don't want to get caught.
All right. Again, I think we're going to take some of the advice from the last question and roll it forward here. Go to the Finder's Go menu. If from the machine that won't see the other one, go to the Finder's Go menu, choose Connect to Server, and you can do one of two things. You can browse from there to see if it appears. If it doesn't, type in AFP for Apple File Protocol, I think. AFP :// and then the IP address of that computer. And if you don't know the IP address of it, go on over to it, go into System Preferences Network, and it should tell you what IP address you're set up as. Type that IP address in, hit connect, and in theory, it should pull up the server. If it doesn't, then that means you've got something more than just, you know, some weird bonjour strangeness. If pointing directly to it doesn't solve it, then either a firewall is turned on, right? Or something's not showing up right. Some service isn't running right. And there's various things you can do to fix that, right? The first would be going to System Preferences, Sharing, and turn file sharing off and then turn it on and see if that kind of, you know, rebuilds things. You got any thoughts about that, John?
At the very least, I would make sure that when you go to the system preferences and you say sharing, is that on both machines, at least at the very least, the same things are checked. So you can, because it sounded like there was a mismatch between this machine sees this one, but this doesn't see that one. So that could be a cause.
Yep.
Just that you have a checkbox checked or unchecked that you didn't mean. So place to start.
Yep. The other thing, I've seen Bonjour get happier if you go and rename both computers, which I believe is in the sharing preference pane, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, if you go into the sharing preference pane at the top, it says computer name. Change it to something else and then close out. That should force it to re-announce itself on the Bonjour network, and that may or may not do it. Hard to say.
And sadly, sometimes in the computer world, just turn everything off.
Yeah, that's right. Just turn it off.
Unplug,
go outside.
Everything. Power up. And actually, I would say, though actually, I don't know about you, Dave, but my advice would be to start with, you know, the maybe routing or network equipment before the computers. I don't know your thoughts.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, cycle power on that stuff and see if anything clears
up. Let it
up.
Settle. Let it do its thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I want to bring this up because James asked about it. He said, where does AppleTalk fit into all this? And the answer is nowhere. AppleTalk is a deprecated protocol. It's not used anymore. TCP IP has replaced it. Unless you have
over TCP, I would say. It's still a protocol, but at a higher level. So it's not totally dead, I hope. Because it's
no, no, dude. It's the same. It doesn't go. You don't have AppleTalk over IP with this, do you? I'm pretty sure AppleTalk was its own protocol, did not require IP.
And well, it can be, yes. But I think you can also tunnel it through IP. So it's at different levels.
Really?
Up on the article.
I know you can tunnel Apple file sharing over IP. And I didn't think you could. I mean, I thought AppleTalk was just its own protocol. Yeah. I mean, from what I'm reading here on Wikipedia, as I'm skimming and talking at the same time, you've got AFP, the Apple filing protocol, which can go either over AppleTalk or over TCP/IP. But I'm pretty sure AppleTalk in and of itself was just a protocol, and that's it. Now,
yes.
Right? Is that right? I think it is.
Go.
Someone out there will correct us if we're wrong, or correct me if I'm wrong. John, of course, may have the right answer on this one. There are like old printers and things like that that didn't support TCP/IP that support only AppleTalk, and that's why that checkbox is there. You can turn on AppleTalk on whatever interface you need that to work on, and then if you've got like an old LaserWriter or something, old.
Serial.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and then there was the local talk cabling, right? And Apple Talk used to talk over local talk, and we could do that with the phone net connectors.
Oh, yes.
Remember that?
Dave and I are tumbling back into the past.
That's right.
We better stop this quick.
why don't we tell them about our second sponsor for this show? Audible is our second sponsor. And we talked about a couple of books, John. The first one, now with Audible, you're able to, if you use the audiblepodcast.com/MacGeekGab link, you get a 2-week free trial of Audible Listener Gold. But in addition to that, you get one free audiobook. And so, you know, John likes to find us an audiobook. Now, go ahead and tell him the first one that you found.
The first one? Really?
Yeah, go ahead. Just quickly. Yeah.
Well, I really like some of the stuff for the younger crowd sometimes, but oh my gosh, where is that? I can't find it. Where is it? I think it was, I'm sorry, Curious George. He's our friend.
He is. It's a good book.
Yep, and he's a monkey. He's curious. But then we were getting onto something that maybe would, because it's a relatively short title, but then we found something. Hey, you know, we got some titles here with Audible that are, you know, quite substantial. And what we found, and Dave and I think agreed on, is Ender's Game. Ender's Game, and they have a special 20th anniversary edition unabridged that I'm just looking here, and length 11 hours. My goodness. But this is, you know, if you ever played video games, maybe this is a cautionary tale. I don't know how much further we want to go with this, but it's someone who crosses the world between video games and real life. And it's just, I think, a very, very good classic sci-fi novel that you're going to get bang for your buck here, because it's long, but I think it's worth it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story. Very hard to describe in 2 minutes here, but it's certainly one of my favorites. I had never read it growing up, and actually my wife Lisa turned me on to it when we were dating back whenever that was, 15 years ago or whatever. And then I wound up reading every book in the series. Orson Scott Card did a fantastic job with this series. And if you haven't read Ender's Game and you're into sci-fi and just the whole psychology behind the human race, really, and all of that, it speaks to so much. In fact, much of what's going on in the world today is kind of echoed in this book, even though it was written many, many years ago. So definitely a good read and a good listen. So there you go. Audible.com, audiblepodcast.com/MacGeekCab. That will get you your free audiobook, and that free audiobook could be Ender's Game for you. So, all right. Moving on to Bob. Which one from Bob? The time machine question. Talking about time machine. We love time machine. Let me stop right here.
Do we?
I said we love time machine. You know, I really do. I mean, this thing, it's a huge technology. What's that?
When it works.
I haven't had any problems with it other than when I've rolled a couple of machines around lately, and if you reinstall an OS or something like that, then you've got to just start over with your time machine backup. But aside from that, I haven't had any problems with it. My time capsule's been working great. Granted, I'm doing everything right by the book by Apple. I'm not trying to do the whole air disk thing or anything, but it is fantastic. I don't worry about it anymore. All my machines are backed up. Anytime I need to restore something, I can just pull it out of the air. I love it. So there you go. That's my endorsement of time.
Well, I like Time Capsule, and actually I did a little over the weekend. I did a little handbrake action.
Okay.
And with the 802N and the MacBook, I was able to stream. So the Time Capsule is almost like a little stealth media server.
Kind of. Yeah.
If you want to put a movie or two on there.
It's a file server. I wouldn't call it a media server.
Yeah, file server. Perfect.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I opened the movie with, QuickTime, played it.
Yep.
Saw it. It was streaming. You know, the bandwidth of the N is enough to keep up with streaming on a reasonable video file. But it was fun.
Cool.
To be able to do that. So I'm very pleased with the Time Capsule.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a remarkable device. Absolutely. All right, Bob, we'll back to you.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Bob from Santa Barbara. I have a question about Time Machine. After our hard disk, the Time Machine disk gets filled, what do we do? I mean, I know if you have a time capsule, so you can plug another disk into it, but does it continue backing up from where the original disk started? I think I would rather, I don't have Time Machine, I think I would rather take my hard disk, fill it up. I don't want to fill it up all the way, because I think you're not supposed to fill a disk to capacity, right? Disconnect at the end, put a new one on, and save the old disk someplace in case of fires and theft and such, and start again. And if I do that, can I at a later date plug the old disk back in, and will Time Machine be able to recognize it and go back into that disk? How does all that work? No one's explained that to me yet. Thanks. Hope you guys can.
Okay, so we've got to unravel this whole thing here. First and foremost, Time Machine will not overfill a disk. The way it is built to work is when you hit the capacity of the drive that it is backing up to, it will go and delete older backups. And that's how it works, right? Time Machine, the first thing it does is it goes and backs up everything. then the next time it comes through, it backs up just those files that have changed, but it doesn't overwrite the first things, right? So you've got this rolling archive of everything and all the changes that you've ever done. Right?
I have to say, in theory.
In theory, yeah. We haven't been using
this.
Because
you and I have not yet seen either of our installations. I don't think you have. I have not. Reach the limit.
No.
So in theory, what you're saying makes perfect total sense in that if the backup utility is aware of the capacity of all the devices and they don't change and nothing weird happens and nobody else is taking up space, but I'm waiting.
Yeah, well, I think it'll know when it, you know, when it hit it. It's always going to look and say how much space is free on this device right now, the moment it starts the backup. And at that point, it decides, okay, do we go and erase older things first, or do we have enough room to back up the things that I know I need to go and back up? And of course, it does hourly backups every day. And then once a day, it kind of consolidates all of those. It takes the most recent one from the day and calls it that day and drops all the hourlies. So it already is rolling stuff out. And once a week, it drops all the days, consolidates to the most recent for that week, and flushes everything out. Once a month, it does the same thing for all the weeks, flushes it out, calls it a month. And then the months are just archived until you don't have room for that anymore. In theory, I've still got about 300 gigs left on my terabyte drive, and I've got a lot of backups on there. You know, all the machines that I've rolled off, I've saved super duper images of it. Just, you know, bam, archive
just
it out
in
there.
Case.
You got it. Yep. And I've used them.
I trust it to an extent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I've used them. I've gone back. And in fact, Lisa's machine, I didn't do a super duper. I just had the Time Machine and she needed to pull something off. And so just like opened up the disk image, went and navigated, pulled the file out. Good to go. No problem. So.
And the thing is, although it's, you know, it's a pain to think about this, even though you have a backup like Time Machine or Time Capsule and you trust it, it doesn't hurt to make another secret backup somewhere else.
Oh yeah.
Of course, I and that's the reason I loved, and you know, we can reminisce a bit, but I love zip disks because they were just about the right size, at least at that point in time.
Right.
100 megabytes, you know, bigger than a floppy, smaller than a, you know,
Red
CD
box.
Or a CDRW or DVD or whatever the kids use these days. No, I'm kidding. What do you have? Dual layer right now? So what?
Yeah.
Eight gigs?
Yeah.
You're talking now?
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. But I've been seeing some cool stuff. Optic cubes and a lot of optical stuff. I think we're going to have a lot of fun.
All right. Are we ready to go on to Marlon's question here? Or do we? I think we unraveled Bob, right? We're good with Bob? I think so.
Okay. Let us know, Bob.
All right. Yeah. Keep us posted, Bob.
Hey, John Dave, it's Marlon again. Just got to talk a little quicker. My cheap cell phone, not an iPhone, dropped out again. I've got a MacBook running 10.4. I just bought a time capsule. I'm looking to upgrade to 10.5, and I wanted to know, I've got about 200 gigs backed up of movies, of my own movies, backed up onto the time capsule, and I wanted to know about that initial drive sync. Is that going to wipe out everything that I have on there? Should I then? I do have an external FireWire drive hooked up to it also, so I'm wondering if I need to put everything on that and keep the time capsule, keep it clean and fresh until I get 10.5. I'd be glad to know. Thanks, guys.
So Marlon is doing something interesting, John. He bought the time capsule before he was able to run Time Machine. So he's just using it presumably as a wireless base station and, as he indicates, a network storage device. And he's just been dumping movies out to it.
Mm-hmm.
When you do a backup to a drive for Time Machine, either one that is connected to your machine or one that's connected to, you know, a time capsule, a network backup, it does not wipe out the drive. If it's one connected directly to your machine, it creates a folder called backups.backupdb, and then inside that folder creates another folder for the disk that you are backing up, or the computer that you're backing up, excuse me. and then folders in there for any of the disks that you're backing up that are attached. With the time capsule, it goes and creates a disk image on the root level of the drive, and then within there, folders and everything, just like the other way. So no, it's not going to wipe out the device at all. If you've already used some space on it, that's fine. It will dynamically deal with that, presumably, as we just discussed. So I think he's fine. Did I get that right, John?
I'm with you, brother.
Okay. You got anything to add? Because I have a cool story to tell, but I don't want to cut our discussion of Marlin's issue short.
Preach on, brother.
All right, hang on. I needed to wet my whistle. So I've mentioned, you know, I'm not much of a gamer. The one type of game that has always kind of, when I was a kid, of course, when you and I met, and even in my teens, I played a lot of games. I liked the adventure games, you know, Zork and Ultima and all sorts of stuff like that. Castle Wolfenstein, Choplifter, right? All that stuff. Mm-hmm. But in my adult or semi-adult life, the only kind of game that I've really ever enjoyed is flight simulators. And it largely because I've flown planes a little bit in the past, not much, but a little bit, and have enjoyed that, and would love to get more into that as I, you know, later on in life. So, but I really like the flight simulators. 10 years ago, we were living in Texas, and for Christmas, Lisa gave me a CH Products yoke with the throttle and the rudder pedals. And it was great, you know, awesome. Now, this was for a Windows machine at the time, and it had those little game port adapters, the 15-pin game port connector. That's how it connected up to the computer. Well, recently, largely because of my brother, I've gotten back into playing X-Plane. And I had a copy of X-Plane 7, just got a copy of X-Plane 9 from the folks at Laminar Research. If you're this is an aside here, but if you're into flight simulators and you've seen X-Plane 7 maybe in the past, upgrade to X-Plane 9. The scenery is absolutely stunning. Totally blew me away the first time I launched it. Absolutely fantastic. Well worth the, whatever it is, the $80 to get a copy of X-Plane 9. So, but you know, so I started playing X-Plane. I thought, well, I'll go out and, like, you know, I'll spend $50 or $60 and get a flight stick. But, you know, right over here outside of the studio, I have kind of this area of old, you know, the graveyard of computer hardware, if you will. It's sort of in the top of our garage, the unfinished part. And I'd always look over and see this old CH Products flight stick. And I started thinking, you know, there's got to be a way. It would kill me not to use this, because this is like the best thing to use. It's the thing they still recommend, except it's got a game port. So I wrote to the folks at CH Products, and they said, yeah, listen, you know, that thing's 10 years old. It's outside of its service life. You need to buy a USB device. And I thought, yeah.
There has to be somebody on their staff, some hacker, some poor soul in the basement that can sympathize with your plight.
I think they sympathized, but they didn't have any answers. And so, in fact, I had asked him, I said, you know, there's got to be an adapter out there, a game port to USB adapter. And they said, no, it won't work with that stuff. Look, you just got to buy a new one, buddy. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I can't really, you can't blame them. 10 years, right? I mean, come on. So, all right. Well, I found, I was searching on some, you know, Malaysian website or something, and found this device called the Super Joy Box. Now, they make a couple of them. And so I need two, right? Because I have the thing for...
Joy Box.
Right. So I have the thing for the yoke, which has the throttle on it, and then the rudder pedals, which also has toe brakes. So I needed a connector that would let me connect two game port adapters up to the machine. And so I found they have the Super Joy Box 6, which will let you do two, and then the Super Joy Box 8, which will let you do four. And the Super Joy Box 6 wasn't in stock. I was like, okay, you know what? The Super Joy Box 8, it was like $15. It was $5 to do slow boat shipping. I couldn't justify doing, you know, $15 fast shipping, because I didn't think the thing was going to work, but I had to know. It was worth a $20 investment to find out. So I wait and I wait, and like 2 weeks goes by, and finally it shows up. Like, all right, woo, you know, I got to try this out. I plug it in, I fire up X-Plane, and it works basically flawlessly. No, all the control surfaces are fine. Some of the buttons don't map quite right. And I'm trying to see if I can use USB overdrive or something to figure it out. You know, it's got, it's got a bunch of buttons on it, but it only reports four buttons back into the machine. And then if the other buttons are chords of the first four, so one button might be 1 and 3, another might be 1, 2, and 4. And that sort of confuses X-Plane. But you know what? It's totally enough to fly the plane. Lots and lots of fun. I've been very, very happy with it. And, you know, in my free time, quote unquote, I've been able to have some fun with this, practicing, you know, ILS landings and that sort of thing.
A happy geek ending.
Oh, yeah. It was awesome. But, I was so happy when I plugged in that thing and it just worked. I was like, no way, you know, because I had the controls and I was like, dude. So if you have an old game port adapter stuck in your basement or stuck in your attic, it might actually work for you. You know, it's worth it. They'll put a link to the Super Joy Box 8, and you never know. You never know. So, you know, mm-hmm. trust your geek instincts on stuff like this, because it could get you something. So I just had to share. I couldn't help but not share. You know how it goes.
And on that note, goodness.
Oh my goodness, what? I'm bringing the band in. Is that okay to bring the band in? Is that all you're saying? Okay.
We told you how to reach us. Yes.
We did. Yeah, MacGeekGab.com for the show notes. Feedback@MacGeekGab.com for your comments. And you can send audio that way. You can send video. You can send pictures. I don't know. I guess we get screenshots.
Spatial, futuristic projections.
There you go. Anything you like. We like it all. I got my paperwork here. I know there's stuff to talk about, but I have the agenda, but I'm all, what's going on here? How did I get to page 3? Where's page 2? What'd you do, John? Did you take page 2 away from me?
What's a page?
We
I'm
talked
virtual,
about that.
Baby.
So the podcast has been converted to AAC by Michael Johnston of iPhone Alley, a great place to get iPhone news. Cashfly Hosting is providing the bandwidth for you to download the podcast. And the podcast marketplace has the A5 and A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebones Software, one free download from audible.com at audiblepodcast.com/MacGeekGab. Text Expander from Smile on My Mac and harman-etravel.com. I think that's it. We're good. We can get out of here, John. So next week, the show certainly won't come Monday. It might come Tuesday. You and I got to talk about that. I sent you an email. I'm at AdTech in San Francisco next week. So flying in Monday, flying out Friday.
What do they talk about?
All kinds of stuff to do with advertising. Association for Downloadable Media has a big presence there, so that'll be a lot of fun.
Nice. And when you're there, Dave, please